This meeting of the Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee will come to order. And today we're looking at issues related to prescription drug and medical device marketing. We do have, as you can see on the agenda, a bill that was introduced last session is a starting point for what will probably be considered this session, and also one without a number yet that's a draft bill on academic detailing. But we have witnesses to speak to the issues in general. People are welcome to comment on provisions in the bill that they have. I don't know if the other one, bill draft, just handed out yet, but we welcome people to comment on the issue in general, and if they have more specific things, that's good too. We'd like to start today with Cody Weiberg from the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy. I welcome to the committee, and please give your name and go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Dr. Cody Weiberg. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy. And what I'm going to speak to today is maybe to lay some framework for the committee, is to go over how the state of the law as it currently exists, give a little bit of history about what the Board of Pharmacy has done with the existing law, which was passed back in 1993, and then give perhaps a little bit of advice from the perspective of someone who's meant to be a regulator. I actually, you'll see some little notes here for me. I was at a conference earlier this week in Washington, D.C., at which this topic was discussed, and so these are my notes from there. And I'll make the same disclaimer here that I did there. The Board of Pharmacy has never taken a formal position on the desirability of a law such as this. What the board has done, as I'll explain, is has given some interpretation to the existing law. And then specifically to this bill, Senate File 3843, I did bring this to the board's attention a couple of months ago, and they instructed me to take the position that the board would not oppose this legislation. Even though this does remove the responsibility from the board to the health department. The reason for that, I think, is twofold. First of all, I think the board realizes as a very small agency, we probably don't have the resources that the health department would have. Secondly, the board's primary mission has always been to license pharmacies, license facilities, such as manufacturers and pharmacies, to inspect facilities, to receive and investigate complaints, and to take disciplinary action when it's appropriate. In short, we're about public safety. When it comes to financial transactions, which this involves, the board actually currently does not even have the authority to look at the financial records of pharmacies. We can go in and inspect a pharmacy. We can look at any records they have, but the law specifically says we can't look at financial records. So in some ways, other than the fact that we license the manufacturers, this whole process might be a better fit in the health department. So the advice that you'll hear is entirely my own opinion. It is not the opinion of the Board of Pharmacy. You may already be aware of this, but Minnesota does have a law in the books. Actually, there's two sections of law that were passed at the same time. In 1993, Minnesota was the first state to have such a law by almost a decade and a half. Recently, other states have passed similar laws and are considering them. There are, again, two sections of the law. One is a gift limit that basically says that manufacturers cannot give to practitioners, and practitioners is defined basically as the people who are allowed to prescribe in the state. Cannot give to practitioners gifts that exceed a $50 limit. The law does not define the word gift, but it does list some payments that are specifically considered not to be gifts. This would include payments made to practitioners for being speakers or for conducting bona fide research or for being consultants and employees. Those are gifts. Payments made to third parties, for example, perhaps the Minnesota Medical Association, for the purpose of sponsoring continuing education programs, samples that are given to patients, and educational materials. Now, the second part of the law is a payment disclosure provision, and some of the payments that are not gifts have to be reported annually to the Board of Pharmacy, but only payments exceeding $100 in value have to be reported. In terms of the history, you might think if I have to talk about the history from 1993 to now, I could take up a lot of the committee's time, but I really don't need to because, frankly, between 1993 and 2005, there was no history. The board really did not do much with this data, just as it has been reported. Now, I'm told by my office manager that it is not true, as was reported in a JAMA article, that the reports sat in cardboard boxes that were actually filed. It was only the most recent year that was in a cardboard box until it could be filed. But basically, the board did not do much with the reports. And again, I came on board in September of 2005, so I'm relying on what my staff tells me. But essentially, there were, I think, a couple of reasons that my predecessor really chose not to do much with this. First, if you take a look at the original language, it does not really instruct the board to do anything with the data. It says the data is public, the reports are public, but it doesn't even tell the board to publicize it. We have done that since 2005, but it really never told the board to do anything with the data. Secondly, until about a year before I started, my office manager tells me that nobody ever wanted to see the data. No one requested it. And again, about a year before I started, some researchers came to see it, is what she told me. It turns out the researchers were from Public Citizen. And they came, they looked at the data, actually we didn't hear any more from them until they published an article in JAMA in January 2007, which was a little bit disappointing because had they followed up with us, they would have found that for entirely practical reasons, we had changed what we were doing with the data. And the history really, the more recent history starts in September 2005 when I started, not because I came in and had an agenda about this issue. Quite frankly, when I came onto the board, I didn't know this law existed. And that changed literally within the first couple of days when I got a call from a Washington, D.C. law firm that was representing manufacturers that asked what I thought was a very simple question. And they wanted to know if meals were considered gifts. And I looked at the statute, came up with what I thought was a reasonable interpretation, called my predecessor to see what he thought. And my predecessor, like myself, was a pharmacist, but he was also trained as an attorney, which I am not. And he said he agreed with me. Unfortunately, about 3 weeks later, the law firm sent me an email to which they attached a letter from my predecessor from 2003 in which he had concluded, based on a different section of statute that deals with gifts to elected public officials, that modest meals given in conjunction with educational activities were not gifts. And in that three-week period, I'd already gotten a number of other calls about this. Was it appropriate to pay physicians to complete marketing surveys? Was it appropriate to pay physicians to attend continuing education programs? Are pharmacists included in the definition of practitioners? And other questions. Since my predecessor was an attorney and I was not, and even though I looked at the other section of law and still didn't quite understand this, because that section of the law says that as an elected public official, if you are a speaker at an educational conference, your meal is free, or you can accept the meal. If you're in the audience, you can't. And so I still didn't see how that law would allow physicians to accept meals as gifts, or without being considered a gift. So what I did is I took all these questions, I sent it over to the Attorney General's office in the form of a request for a formal legal opinion, and the AG's office agreed with my interpretations of the questions. And that's formed the basis of a frequently asked questions document that's on our website. In essence, when it comes to meals, what the board has done then in January of 2006 is the board did adopt the Attorney General's opinion as the official board position. And in terms of the meals issues, basically, if a manufacturer indirectly sponsors continuing education by giving an unrestricted grant to a third party, the meals in that case would not be a gift. In any other case, they're a gift, including food that's brought in just at lunchtime. So that was one thing that happened. The other thing that happened is Gardner Harris, a reporter from the New York Times, came into the office a few months after that. He wanted copies of some of the reports, and I had my staff copy hundreds, if not a couple thousand pages for him. A month or so after he was there, a researcher from California wanted copies of hundreds, or maybe a couple thousand pages. Finally, when Tom Scheck from Public Radio wanted the information about a month after that, I decided really it was an inefficient use of my staff time to have them copying thousands of pages every month. So in the summer of 2006, about 6 months before the JAMA article came out, I had my staff scan all of the reports that were at that time into Adobe Documents so that the next time a reporter or a researcher wanted the data, we could burn it onto a CD and send it to them. Then the JAMA article did hit in January 2007, and that sparked widespread interest, and not just from reporters, although we had a lot of requests from reporters for the data, but we had healthcare systems in the state. We had hospitals, we had clinics, we had individual doctors, all who wanted this data. We even had an elderly couple who was suing their doctor for malpractice who wanted copies of the data to see if he was somehow in there. So at that point, we took the scanned documents and we put them on our website and where they are today. What we did with the last reporting cycle is another criticism we had even of the scanned documents is they're not searchable. So we gave instructions to manufacturers during this last reporting cycle to go to our website and to download an Excel spreadsheet and to fill out that Excel spreadsheet with the data and to submit it to us electronically so we could put the spreadsheets on the website. Regrettably, only about 50% of the manufacturers complied, and the rest still sent in paper reports. So I think that's pretty much the history. Now, one of the things that we're still getting quite frequently are questions about certain issues from the manufacturer. So one question that we've had is, what does it mean? What does educational materials mean? And basically, the board has come up with the position that the legislature, the original intent probably was the materials that a manufacturer would use to directly market their product. So it could be journal reprints, it could be their own promotional materials. It was not medical textbooks or subscriptions to online information sources, which some of the manufacturers were wondering if they could provide. So that's just one example of many questions we've had about the nuances of this. So in terms of advice, and again, these are all my own opinions based on the 3 years or so I've been involved in trying to enforce the current legislation, definitions are important. And the board has adopted the definition of gifts that's in the section of statute that deals with gifts to elected public officials. But that's an important thing to have. Also, one of the other questions that we had involved, again, whether it was appropriate to pay physicians to complete marketing surveys or to participate in marketing research. And the board has said, no, that is probably not what the legislature meant when it talked about bona fide research. We think the legislature meant clinical research, not marketing research. And I've already mentioned educational materials, so we've had to come up with our definition of what educational materials are. For the data to be useful to anyone, it should probably not just be public, but also be publicized, which the board has been doing. And I think there is direction in this bill to have the health department publicize the data. The agency who's going to have enforcement responsibility should probably have specific authorization to promulgate rules. And that's because, again, of all these questions that we've received, no matter what you put in legislation, there probably will be new questions that arise where it would be useful to have authority to promulgate rules. Provide the agency with the resources needed to carry out the job. One of the issues I think the board had is, again, at that time I think we had 9 employees, and even today it's very difficult to make this a priority when we have to literally investigate, and take action when pharmacists are stealing narcotics and using them on the job and directly endangering the public. Require electronic reporting, which makes compiling a database much easier. And there is at least one company out there that is developing tracking software. And this company told me actually that in developing their software, they actually took the data that we had put on the website to create a database to test their software. And I've had a chance to look at it, and it's impressive software. Include all healthcare providers and their employees. This is another question that we've frequently had, because the current law mentions only practitioners. So we've had a sort of rule on what it means if a pharmaceutical sales rep brings lunch in to a doctor's office. Is it a gift to practitioners if non-practitioners, the nurses, the physical therapists, the receptionists, eat the food? Well, the board has said, the law actually says practitioners. It says nothing about pharmacists even. So it would be probably useful to include practitioners and their employees, actually all healthcare providers. Then I think that's sort of the gist of the advice that I would give. And with that, I would take any questions from the committee.
Questions from the committee. Dr. Weiberg, with the field draft from last session, of your recommendations, there two of those things are already in, but the definitions you were saying should be, there should be some.
Yes, as I was preparing for this talk I gave in Washington, that's one thing that occurred to me. It's like, some definitions of some of the terms would be useful.
And then also authority to promulgate rules.
Right, and the board probably would have had, the board has general authority to promulgate rules anyway, but something that specifically, for example, gives the health department that authority and makes it clear that they can do that might be useful. Because I think as things have evolved, these questions come up, and the manufacturers do think of other things that they might be able to, or that might want to do along this line. And, we've handled it now at this point just by doing interpretation, which is satisfactory, but that might be a useful thing.
Questions from the committee? Not. Thank you very much for that history. It all happened after you came there, huh?
Well, there have been folks, including Pete Wyckoff, who sometimes embarrassed me by saying nothing happened until I started there. I assure you, this was, as Gardner Harris put it in one of his articles, accidental. When I look at policymaking, and I've done this for a decade now, first at Medicaid and now here, I think of policymaking as you identify a problem, you research the options, you select the option you think is appropriate, put the policy in place, and you evaluate it. This was not that way. This was accidental. This was coming into the board and responding to questions from the manufacturers and then the publicity for it. I mean, so it had my predecessor not retired and been there, he might have done the same thing. So I really can't, I don't want to take credit for it. It just was, happened to be there when all this hit.
So, made an interesting time. Thank you very much. Next witness, Marjorie Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Marjorie Powell. I'm the Senior General Counsel for the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, or PhRMA. We represent the women and the men who are researching, discovering, and developing the new medicines that are making healthcare more effective and are improving the lives of patients through new treatments. I'd like to talk first about the PhRMA code, because we do have a code on interactions with healthcare professionals, and then briefly about some of the issues in other states that have implemented disclosure requirements following Minnesota's lead. And then I'd like to talk very briefly about some of the concerns I would have with both the draft legislation and some of the... I would also like to echo Cody's recommendation for definitions and regulatory authority, because I think those are very important. Let me start with the PhRMA code. As nearly as I can tell, PhRMA has had a code on interactions with healthcare professionals almost since the trade association existed. Back in the 1980s, we actually adopted the code that the AMA had established for physicians, and we said to our member companies that they should comply with the kinds of requirements that physicians had imposed upon themselves. The current code, which was revised in 2002 and then updated with a set of questions and answers in 2004, is in effect until the end of this calendar year. Last July, we adopted a further revision of our code, and I see that you all now have copies of that one. At least for my assistants, they changed the color of the covers so I can keep track easily of which one I need to grab. This new one takes effect January 1. It is the result of months and months and months of work. When we have been listening to a number of sources, and when we decided that we needed to update our code to adjust to some changing practices in healthcare, we went through a fairly extensive process to make a decision about what sorts of things to revise in our code, whether to add some additional things, what kinds of changes we made. We listened to concerns that we heard, frankly, from state legislators and from federal legislators over the last couple of years. We talked to physicians, both individual physicians in focus groups and medical societies. We talked to the AMA. We talked to a variety of physician specialty societies. We talked to the American Academy of Family Physicians. And we then went to healthcare providers, by which we mean the hospitals and the academic medical centers, and we said what kinds of things are of concern to you. And we listened to comments and criticism by groups like the Prescription Project, Healthcare for All, the Senior Federation here in Minnesota, and a variety of other groups. We also, frankly, looked at codes of conduct that a variety of other industries have, some of them healthcare industries, some of them totally outside of the healthcare area. We looked at a number of our own company codes, because while PhRMA has had a code, all of our companies have adopted their own codes, some of which are much more comprehensive, address a wider variety of areas than the PhRMA code does. And then lastly, and throughout the process, we conferred with the Antitrust Council, because as a voluntary trade association, we have to be sure that we are not in the position of creating, either actually getting our companies involved in a group boycott or creating winners and losers among potential vendors or doing, creating the impression that we are doing that. So throughout this process, we had anti-social counsel involved very heavily, and occasionally things are worded in a lawyer's fashion that would make Cody's hair curl, because the antitrust lawyers said you have to be sure and leave this more voluntary than perhaps you might like to. Even with that said, we have had a series of complaints from vendors who said you're encouraging or requiring your companies to essentially give up using my company's services. So that's always a concern, but we're trying to balance between listening to the concerns of critics, but also recognizing that the pharmaceutical company, which has developed a new medicine, which has years and years and years of research, which is continuing to monitor information received from physicians who are using that medicine, reporting all that information to the FDA, recommending changes in labeling, recommending that the medicine should not be used perhaps for this category of patients, that information is absolutely essential to the people who are prescribing that medicine. And that the first and most important obligation of a pharmaceutical company when it puts a medicine on the market is to make sure that the people who will be prescribing that medicine or providing advice to patients call in and say, I'm having this kind of reaction, that those people have all of the information they need about how to use that product. So all of this needs to be put in the context of not only the physician or the nurse practitioner or the dentist who is actually prescribing, but everybody within that healthcare practice needs to know information about how to take that medicine, what to do if you're having an adverse reaction, what is likely to be an adverse reaction. So that's the crucial context for this information. Now, that said, we adopted this new revised code in July of 2008. It becomes effective in January of 2009 because companies had to go through their own codes and revise them and, in a number of cases, make sure that they've changed their training programs, make sure that they have their internal policies in place to implement the new provisions in the code, to train all of their people. In this instance, the training involves not just the pharmaceutical representatives who are interacting with physicians and healthcare providers, but also all of the people who are working in the area of support for continuing medical education, all of the people who would be planning and hosting conferences. Let me talk briefly about some of the changes that we've made. Those people who have the new code also have a chart which identifies some of the changes that we made. We continue to say that it's vitally important that pharmaceutical representatives provide accurate, up-to-date information to healthcare providers. But in doing that, they need to be sure that all of their communications occur in a setting where that information can be conveyed. And to that end, we've said that it is inappropriate for pharmaceutical representatives to be taking healthcare providers out for meals in a restaurant setting, that it is still appropriate to bring an occasional modest meal into the physician's office because physicians are busy people. You can catch them frequently while they're taking their 15-minute break for lunch. And that's a way of both giving them and their staff, in many instances, an attraction to come and hear the most recent information about a medicine. And I'd like to emphasize that it's important not only for the prescriber, but for the person who is going to be answering the patient's questions. And when I call my doctor's office, I don't know, I assume that in Minnesota the The healthcare systems are fairly similar. I don't often get to actually talk to the doctor. I will talk to the nurse practitioner who will take down my question, talk to the doctor on the fly, and then come and call me back and answer my question. So everybody needs to have all of the information. We've said that if a pharmaceutical representative is going to be providing any kind of a gift to a healthcare provider, it must be patient education focused. So it's acceptable to provide the brochure that describes what are the symptoms of diabetes, how should I be treated, why is it important that I watch my diet and I get exercise or take my medicine consistently. It is not appropriate to provide a pen or a cup, or my favorites are the boxes of tissues with the name of the medicine on the side. I do need to tell you that we have had many, many complaints from the companies who make pens and tissue boxes and cups, as well as complaints in a number of instances from restaurants saying, you're putting me out of business. And we've had to say we think that it's important that scientific and medical information get conveyed in a setting where the physician or the nurse practitioner can focus on that information. Therefore, we're not allowing our companies to provide pens, other kinds of tchotchkes. So that's, in one sense, sort of a tribute to Minnesota, because, Cody, I think it is probably a result of the Minnesota gift ban that the industry as a whole is now in some ways catching up with that kind of ban. We've also said that if you are, we have a whole series of provisions about what you're to do if you're providing continuing medical education support and how that activity needs to be separated from the activities of providing marketing information about your drug, and that support needs to be consistent with the rules of ACCME, which is the National Accrediting Body. And a number of the expanded provisions in our code address how you can provide continuing medical education support. We think it's important that physicians have continuing medical education because there's always new information about diseases and treatment options, not just new medicines, but a variety of treatment options. And the pharmaceutical industry is one of, but not the only, supporter of those kinds of conferences. But those need to be done in a way that not only physicians, but everybody else is confident that the people providing the education are doing it on an unbiased, non-promotional basis. We've also talked about company speaker programs and the kinds of protections that need to be built in so that companies are hiring and training speakers, monitoring them to make sure that what they are saying about a particular medicine is consistent with what the FDA allows the company to say about the medicine. We added in this version of the code, a provision on the use of prescriber identifiable information because that has been a concern in some states. We've also, in this instance, added a fairly extensive set of compliance mechanisms. We're asking all of our companies and actually any pharmaceutical company or biotech company, whether they are a member of pharma or not, to let us know if they are going to be complying with the new pharma code. And we've been posting those names on our website for a number of months. We're asking companies to identify the name of their chief compliance officer and contact information. And we're going to be posting that on our website so that if somebody has a concern or a complaint, they know how to get to the compliance officer in an individual company. Because the reality is Just as there are always children in elementary school who will misbehave, there will always be pharmaceutical representatives who decide that they know better than their company what it is that should be done in a particular situation. And we want to make it very easy for anyone in the healthcare system or the patients to say to a company compliance officer, I was in this situation and I think your pharmaceutical representative acted inappropriately. Because the only way the company can protect itself from those kinds of problem employees is to know about them. We're asking our companies to verify on a yearly basis that they have policies and procedures to comply with our code, and we're encouraging them to, on a yearly basis, have an outside company verify that they have policies and procedures and that they are, in fact, following those policies and procedures. All of that information is available on our website, and we're working very hard to make sure that the companies are implementing those programs. We actually have been asked to talk with a variety of groups, including, most importantly, medical groups, doctors' associations, who want to know why it is we've modified the code and what the constraints are. And frankly, we also get questions occasionally. The one I had the other day was that one of the hotel chains had been told that the pharmacode prohibited meetings at that particular hotel chain. And I said, no, the pharmacode said that there shouldn't be meetings at resorts. If that hotel chain is marketing itself as solely a resort facility, then maybe the companies are saying we can't meet there, but pharma hasn't sort of targeted individual groups like that. But I suspect what's happened is that a company has said, that's a fairly high-end hotel chain, you can't just automatically book any kind of event at one of those hotels. So I do know that companies are working very hard to come into compliance with the code. Are there any questions about the code? And if so, I'd be happy to answer them. Otherwise, I'd like to shift for just a couple of minutes to what other states are doing to sort of provide some context.
Go ahead. We have some questions, but go ahead with the other states first.
All right. There are a number of states that actually have been looking at what Minnesota has done. And sort of following Minnesota's lead in a variety of ways, none of them have done exactly the same thing as Minnesota. So that there are, I think now, six states that require disclosure of some kinds of payments. In some cases, they are payments to physicians. In other cases, they are payments for advertising or marketing. Every one of those states has a slightly different definition of a number of the things to be reported. And I'd like to echo Cody's comment that definitions are important, because what we found is the regulators often don't have any real concept of the entire industry that they are regulating. And what they end up doing is creating definitions that are unworkable for companies, in part because they may be inconsistent with other states, they may be inconsistent with FDA requirements, they may be inconsistent with requirements in the CMS regulations for Medicare or Medicaid programs, and the companies then end up reporting inconsistent kinds of information. And the record-keeping process gets very difficult. But there are, I think, five or six states now that include disclosure requirements. Most of them allow electronic filing or, in some instances, require electronic filing. But in at least two states, they required electronic filing but weren't prepared for the electronic filing, so that the website onto which companies were to file their reports wasn't functional until 2 weeks after the reports were due, and there was a daily penalty for being late in filing your report. Because nobody had thought about giving the agency that was accepting the report the resources necessary to compile this information or even accept the information.
Ms. Powell, on that point, just a quick question. With the Board of Pharmacy here, that when they started asking for electronic filing, you're not suggesting they had the forms, or at least the what Mr. Weiberg said about the they had the spreadsheets out there for people to fill out. They had that in advance of the request. Is that correct?
I think the spreadsheet was available in advance of the filing date, but of course one of the difficulties is if the spreadsheet doesn't fit the way the company has been recording the information, so that the company can't just fill in transfer from their electronic database to the spreadsheet, but actually has to have somebody go through manually and recalculate, that can create problems. And in addition, sometimes because there are differences in definitions or differences in coding systems, there are problems in getting information into spreadsheets. But I think working from an Excel spreadsheet would be more efficient. One of the problems that the companies have reported, though, is that because each state's systems are different from every other state, and that the definitions differ, the coding categories in which you're reporting things differ, there and the definitions in many cases are unclear or lumped together, two or three different things, that creates problems. And frankly, what that does from the state's perspective is add to their costs of administration in ways that aren't that don't do anything to improve.
Ms. Powell, I'm going to suggest, because I worry about how many witnesses we have, because we have two issues we want to get to, that we not go through the other states, unless you're suggesting that the board here, with their forms and so on, aren't ready for it or aren't prepared, because I recognize that other states are catching up with Minnesota, perhaps, but we do have two bills here and about four more witnesses on this one and four on the next one, and you may want to be speaking to the next one, too. So,
all right, let me turn then very quickly to the legislation. I have concerns with a couple of particular sorts of things. One is the definition of samples as it's identified here on page 2, I'm looking at, it's lines 2.5 through 2.7. And I think that because samples are very frequently new products, there may well not be evidence-based medicine, and in almost all instances, there will not be evidence of clear superiority as FDA defines that. And as a pharmaceutical company regulated by the FDA, the company would have to use that information. So that may very well result in essentially an exclusion of samples for many, many products. And I do know that there are some groups who think that samples are not appropriate, but from the industry's perspective, samples are vitally important because it allows the physician and the patient to try a new product to see if it will work for this patient, because each patient reacts differently to every medication, and it allows the patient to try the medicine without incurring the cost of buying a full prescription. The patient can try a 5-day or a 10-day sample, see if they're going to have one of the hopefully rare but serious adverse reactions, or that it won't work. I sometimes use the example when my mother, who had osteoporosis, was diagnosed with high blood pressure. She went through I think, 6 different medications before they found one that would actually lower her blood pressure and not make her dizzy when she stood up. And, of course, if you've got osteoporosis, they don't want you to be standing up and falling over. So in that kind of situation, the ability to try a medicine with a small sample rather than a 30-day prescription was vitally important. So I think...
One question, though, when we're talking about samples here, for free distribution to uninsured and low-income patients, what you're describing sounds to me like you're doing some sort of research, clinical and evaluation of how it affects certain people and so on.
I think every physician, when they prescribe a medicine, particularly if it's the first time a patient has taken the medicine, is watching to see how the patient is going to react to this medicine, how it will interact with the other medicines the patient is taking, whether the patient can in fact swallow the medicine and remember how to take it properly, whether it's one time a day or 3 times a day, with food, without food.
So here you're not talking about the new ones, you're talking about the existing drugs that have been around for a while, and that if I'm a doctor and I prescribe to you certain drug, that I might want to give you a few days supply to see.
That's right. Yes, I think samples are very important for uninsured and low-income people, but they're also important for the physician and the patient to see if this medicine will work for you. So I think you want to be careful not to exclude those. I'm looking at also item number 6, the reporting of salaries. As I read that, if I am a physician who is an employee of a pharmaceutical company based here in Minnesota and I want to volunteer at a local clinic one day a week, that means that I need to make my salary at the pharmaceutical company public. My company may not appreciate that, and it may make it more difficult for me to get permission to go and volunteer. I may not want to do that, and it adds an extra burden for my volunteering. So I think you need to look at a variety of the unintended consequences. What we found as other states have implemented disclosure requirements is that they very frequently do have unintended consequences. Massachusetts is now in the process of notice and comment rulemaking for its regulations, which will require disclosure for drug and device companies. And as I read the proposed regulations, they actually may have to require companies to list the value of samples and the name of every physician who receives a sample. And there is a concern among physicians in the state that will be treated as if they've received a gift. And from our perspective, samples are not a gift to the physician. They're not a benefit to the physician. They're a necessary part of the healthcare system, important particularly for low-income or uninsured or underinsured patients. I'd also like to point out...
That's your second one?
Number 6 is the
one you just mentioned, yeah.
The one I just mentioned.
Thank you.
But I think, and I've frankly not had time to go through this very closely, there may well be other things that would have unintended consequences. But I'd also like to point out that this is focused on pharmaceutical companies and medical device companies, but physicians consistently confirm that the most important thing they consider when they are making prescribing decisions is the formulary that the insurance company has imposed for that patient. That the insurance companies provide information to the physicians about the formularies. They provide a variety of information about medicines they think are most important. That information is not based on research. It's not based on looking at the experiences of physicians using the medicine. It is essentially based on cost decisions. If physicians rely on formularies, then it seems to me that disclosure from everybody influencing the physician's prescribing practices may be appropriate. In addition, pharmacy benefit managers are instrumental in guiding physicians, particularly when the insurer or the pharmacy benefit manager is paying physicians to switch patients from one drug to another. So I think the issue of manufacturers' interactions with healthcare professionals is important, but it's only one small piece of the picture, and I would encourage you to think very broadly about who it is that is influencing healthcare professionals. But I also think it's important to remember that research is important, and you really want to make sure that nothing that you're doing is discouraging research. And I'd be very careful looking at the how you define reimbursement for participation in clinical trials, because I think that that may require skills that are different from what the physician normally uses in his or her practice. And perhaps it justifies a different rate of reimbursement. And given the variety of medical centers here in Minnesota and the number of clinical trials going on, I don't know that you really want to discourage Minnesota physicians from participating in trials. But that is a different task than their normal practice, and you need to not impose restrictions that are going to discourage.
So, excuse me, just for clarification, that means, in other words, on page 2, line 20, what the genuine clinical research project is, you're concerned that clinical is too...
Well, one, I'm concerned with both clinical may be too broad, because some of it may be pre-clinical. I want a dozen pediatricians to come help me figure out why it is that preschool patients can't or don't consistently take the medicine they're supposed to be taking for X. For example, diabetes, which I understand is an important issue in Minnesota, particularly with the most recent grant. Young children with type 1 diabetes who have to take insulin, if the development of insulin pumps so that the insulin could be monitored consistently throughout the day was, I understand from parents of such young children, a major breakthrough. I'm sure that there were a variety of pediatricians involved in that activity well before they actually got to the point of testing that in human beings. So all of that would be preclinical work. So I think that definition, and also maybe not at the physician's standard practice doing it, because, as I say, they're doing some extra specialized things that may call for a different reimbursement rate.
Thank you. That's helpful.
Let me stop and ask you if I can address any questions. Can I have if I have the opportunity, I will go through this. And if I have any further
please, we would appreciate that, ideally in the next month or so, yes. Yeah. Thank you. Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Powell, can you give us any sense of how many Minnesota companies have indicated an interest in adopting the new pharma code?
I apologize. It did not occur to me to go back and look at that. It would be posted on our website, and I can certainly do that and get that to you.
Mr. Chair, I think that would be helpful information for the committee, and I have two other comments. One is, I appreciated your comments, particularly with regard to, page 2, number 1, with regard to the professional samples. And I would just point out, in all of this discussion, I hope, and I think what we're looking here for is I hope some balance, and I don't want to lose sight of the need for cost containment and how this fits in with the overall health reform measures that we are seeking to gain in Minnesota. And I would suggest that a person's socioeconomic means in terms of the healthcare cost containment is not a factor. And anyone that, I think you made a really good point about when I'm being prescribed a new medication, it doesn't matter if I have a job or don't have a job, or if I make $10,000 a year or $110,000 a year. I'm at the same, I may have a reaction to that medication in any of those situations, and I don't think we should distinguish that. The second comment and final comment that I'll make is just that I hope, and we have a lot of testimony yet to hear, that we exercise some caution here. And Ms. Powell, you talked about trying to give us some guidance so that we don't run into unintended consequences. And I, while recognizing that I don't have a lot of experience in the Senate, I do think and I do believe that, frankly, the legislature has been a victim of some unintended consequences with regard to the gift ban in this state.
Sir, which some don't think they were unintended consequences.
Mr. Chair, duly noted.
Ms. Powell, the one thing that struck me most about your presentation was your comment that when PhRMA developed a new code that some restaurant owners actually complained the ban would put them out of business. How much business do they get from these guys?
I suspect that was in a location where they were near a clinical research facility. But my sense was, if that's what's keeping your business going, you shouldn't be in business. But there had been, I think, some excesses, particularly with things like restaurant meals. And I think some of that, not to malign physicians, but some of it was sort of a physician-driven. I've had physician groups tell me that they think it's outrageous that they can't go out to dinner. And in some ways, when you think about it, I know this is true of legislators as well, but within the legal profession, it's not uncommon for a law firm that wants to pitch business to me as a lawyer at the trade association to say, can I take you to lunch? Yeah. It doesn't happen with legislators in many cases. And I know that at the federal level, since I'm in Washington, one of my jobs is to make sure our federal people understand the new federal regulations. I know how hard that can be. But there has been, I think, a concern. There is always a concern when you change the ground rules, that practices that people thought were acceptable are suddenly no longer acceptable. It's hard to remember that you can't allow a Hill staffer to join you on a cab ride when you're both going from the same location to the same location without asking that Hill staffer to pay for half of the cab fare, because otherwise it's a gift.
Ridiculous. So,
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before we do stray, are we actually working on the bill?
No, but feedback on the bill would be helpful.
Okay, I'd like to echo Senator Lynch's comments that we eventually strike uninsured or low income from line 2.6. Also, echoing the comments that we need to gauge tolerance to the patients regardless.
Thank you. Ms. Powell, I see you're not listed as one of the witnesses on the academic detailing bill. I was just curious if you had any, either whether you're going to comment on that one later or if you have just a very brief comment about what you think of the idea of getting accurate information to doctors through having academic people make the presentations.
Well, it seems to me that anyone making presentations to physicians on any aspect of healthcare, whether it's a particular medicine, whether it's the range of medicines available for treatment of diabetes or treatment of colon cancer or whatever it might be, that all of those people should be subject to the same rules. FDA regulates the pharmaceutical companies and the medical device companies. FDA does not have any authority over academic detailers. But if academic detailers are, in fact, out talking with physicians or anyone else about a particular treatment area, they, it seems to me, should have the same obligation to provide information that is research-based, that is clinically appropriate, that is fair and balanced, that they should also be subject to the same disclosure and limitations as pharmaceutical companies. I know that, well, I get materials from the two hospitals that are in my geographic area. Because I'm a local person, I get their newsletters. And one of the things I see very frequently is lunch and learn announcements. Please send your doctors from the Eastern Shore of Maryland, which is a very rural area, to our lunch and learn at Restaurant X, where we will tell you about why you should send your patients having heart attacks to our hospital rather than the other hospital.
I understand it. I was curious, though, in Massachusetts and Pennsylvania, I don't know how many states have academic detailers. Have any of them been doing anything like giving gifts or anything of that you're aware of?
My understanding is that the academic detailers working in Pennsylvania have concluded that it is important for their access to not only the physician but others in the physician's office that they bring either donuts in the morning or pizzas for lunch or sandwiches, or that there is the same, they are encountering the same problem with busy healthcare practitioners, that they don't get any time or attention unless they're sort of fitting into the time when those people are not actually seeing patients or filling in medical charts. But at the moment, in neither Massachusetts nor Pennsylvania are they regulated. And frankly, nobody goes back and looks at whether what they say is accurate. And just like Cody said that the authors of the JAMA article didn't check back with him and therefore presented out-of-date and potentially inaccurate information, academics are subject to different, but subject to pressures that may result in conflict of interest.
That's helpful to know, and the bill is put together to make sure they comply with the same code. I would care to guess that the detailers who have been, as you said, bringing donuts are finding it hard to compete with manufacturers who are bringing much more, because that's, I presume, in Pennsylvania they were bringing much more in the past, but I'm just curious if that wasn't.
Actually, I think that if you talk to physicians, you'll find that in most cases what the detailers are bringing are coffee and donuts, bagels, cupcakes,
pizza.
I know there are reports of lavish meals and so on, but I think those are there's a lag time between what gets reported in the press and what's actually happening, and sometimes I think the press is several years behind the current reality.
Well, thank you very much. Any other questions from the committee? No, thank you. Toby Tanzer, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Toby Tanzer. I'm the Vice President of Corporate Integrity and the Corporate Compliance Officer for Health Partners. But I'm here today representing the Physician Leadership Policy Forum, or the PLPF. The PLPF is an informal collaboration among physician leaders from several of the Twin Cities' largest healthcare providers, including Allina, Fairview, Children's, Health Partners, Park Nicollet, and the University of Minnesota Physicians. Unfortunately, because of patient care and clinic obligations this morning, none of the PLPF physicians themselves was able to attend this hearing. However, since the PLPF's work for more than 2 years has focused primarily on the very issues that this bill addresses, they asked me to come today to convey their strong support of Senate File 3843. I would like to begin my comments with some background about the PLPF and its members' particular interest in the issue of transparency and industry relations. Then I will explain why PLPF is supportive of this bill. In 2005, several physician leaders from our community came together to share perspectives on questions involving physician professionalism, patient trust, patient safety, and the affordability of healthcare. While there were many topics they were interested in, the one that emerged as the top priority was the issue of relationships between physicians and suppliers of pharmaceuticals and medical devices. During their regular meetings, PLPF members have educated themselves and their own organizations about the benefits and challenges of physician-industry relations, explored alternatives to the current state of these relationships, and shared best practices. In 2007, they jointly wrote an op-ed piece on physician-industry relationships that was published in the St. Paul Pioneer Press under the name of Dr. Brian Rank, who is Health Partners Medical Director. And this was published on behalf of, he wrote this on behalf of the PLPF. I have brought a copy of that piece with me today for the committee members to read. And you will note that in it, Dr. Rank, on behalf of the PLPF, calls for some of the same reforms that Senate File 3843 contains. There is no disagreement about the importance of involving industry in healthcare research and clinical trials, professional education, and innovation in medical care. None of these things can occur unless caregivers and industry collaborate and communicate. But increasing competition for the attention and loyalty of physicians has led to interactions between suppliers and practitioners that range from gifts, meals, and lavish entertainment events to overly compensated consulting and speaking arrangements to subsidized travel and ghostwriting and educational sessions that are in fact simply promotional events. These pervasive and sometimes extravagant arrangements create conflicts of interest, contribute to the spiraling costs of healthcare, interfere with professional independence and the primacy of the physician-patient relationship, and undermine patient trust in the medical profession. Moreover, for the most part, these relationships have historically been invisible to patients and to the public at large. Without greater transparency, healthcare organizations will continue to struggle with how to manage conflicts of interest among their physician staff, and patients will continue to question whether their doctor's loyalty lies with their own personal financial interests rather than with their patient's medical interests. Although Minnesota's current law was a good step, and it was unique nationally when it was first enacted, the bill before this committee would improve the current law in several critical ways. It would eliminate the waste and expense of frivolous and unnecessary gifts to practitioners. It would bring much-needed transparency to industry-practitioner relationships by requiring the disclosure of financial payments to caregivers by medical device manufacturers as well as by pharmaceutical companies. And it would also bring more consistency to the reporting process and make those reports more understandable and accessible by patients and the general public. This bill will help ensure that patients, the public, practitioners, and healthcare organizations have more complete and relevant information about caregivers' relationships with industry, so people can make better informed choices about their care. On behalf of the physician leaders of the PLPF, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to express our support for and to provide comments on this bill. And I would also be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. And Ms. Tanzer, the article you did present, the staff just told me they presented, we've handed out to the committee.
Okay, great. Thank you.
The Brian Ranklin. Thank you very much. Any questions from members of the committee? Thank you very much. Dr. Chris McCoy. You can go whatever order you want.
Yeah. The timing is getting tough, Chris.
Right.
So good. You should go.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Good morning. I'm Dr. Christopher McCoy. I'm a physician at Mayo Clinic, and today I'm speaking on behalf of the National Physicians Alliance, a nationwide organization of physicians. I've previously spoken upon the gifts and impact on physicians, and so I will mostly limit my comments and response to some of the questions that have been addressed today. As you know, physicians are increasingly contacted by drug companies in ways to alter our prescribing habits, often in ways that can be detrimental to both cost and potentially even patient health with tools such as Vioxx. I do commend the pharma for their recent changes to their guidelines. I think this does reflect the sort of the boom and bust cycle of how promotion has been done, where there's a series of excesses and then new guidelines are put into place, and then we've those guidelines, they find the loopholes, work around them, and another series of excesses. And so I think it's important that we maintain a push to keep the guidelines being reformed, but also hit the eventual goal of all physicians and the industry working together for what is in the best interest of the patients at the best cost to all providers. Briefly, I did want to mention the question about samples in the text of legislation. There's a couple things I, as a provider, I've echoed the comments that were previously made, where we do occasionally use samples in such a way that it allows a patient to try a drug to see if there's any reaction to it. So that does happen. Unfortunately, studies have shown that most samples end up going to a middle class or higher patients, just because most samples are given to private practicing physicians to see those patients. That being said, I would be comfortable with that language of under and low income being stricken from that, because there is an appropriate role for samples to be used for all patients. A second issue with the evidence-based qualifications is that this does potentially create a potential loophole in the sense of, as a provider, I'm allowed to prescribe the medication for any indication to my patients, not just necessarily one that's FDA-approved, one that's regulated. And so while there are medicines that are demonstrated clear superiority, an example I could give is a medication called Lyrica, which is used for neuralgia in diabetes, and is evidence proven to be successful in treating that. However, if a physician was provided samples with that, they could give those samples out for any indication, such as low back pain or other things that there are is not such robust evidence. And so while having that language in the bill, I understand the intent may not actually have the result that you may want. Since
Dr. McCoy, could I ask for clarification? In other words, you're saying that the fact that they can provide the sample if there's evidence-based medicine to support the clear superiority, you're saying that then they... What was the concern? What's the loophole there?
Then it places the onus on the physician to demonstrate that they're giving the sample for that indication for which there's superior evidence, which as physicians we don't necessarily have that. Okay.
So it shouldn't be the physician who's making the determination of the...
Right. So once a sample, a drug has been proven to be superior, it can be given to a physician for, but then after that it can be distributed for any reason. So that's just one nuance that I think may come out. Otherwise, I think Minnesota has been a great leader in this, this deal of limiting gifts and influencing on physicians. And it's something that I wish to see pursued in greater context. I have additional comments in active detailing, but I'll save those.
Okay. Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome, Dr. McCoy. I would echo your concerns in section 1 on the evidence-based medicine. I had made some notes on that as well. I'm not sure If I made my notes for the same reason that you made your notes, but that's really not important. What is important is that I think that that is that that does sort of complicate the issue before us, and it is my hope that I think perhaps what we're trying to get at there might more appropriately, and I think is being handled in terms of the health reform, in terms of some of the things that we're doing with healthcare homes and payment reform and how we are structuring co-payments. So I think there's some work being done in that area to support evidence-based work in medicines.
Then I may be misunderstanding because I thought you two were saying opposite things. With the evidence-based support clause in there, you're saying you don't like the clause. I thought you were saying the clause has a loophole in it where they could use it for something other than with the evidence-based medicine. In other words, they could get the medicine if it's evidence-based medicine. If some drug is better than another one based on evidence-based medicine, for one use, that then I could give the doctors much of that they want, and they can use it for whatever purpose that they choose. That's what I thought you were saying.
Correct. That is what I'm saying. The clause here will probably not have the intended response.
Mr. Chair and Dr. McCoy, so perhaps I jumped ahead and interpreted that to mean that that you felt that language didn't necessarily wasn't as strong as maybe it was implied to be, and so I'm thinking that we should not have that evidence-based language in this bill for that, the reason you've indicated, and other reasons.
I think this is an area that we need to, some tailoring of the language to meet the goal of making sure that the samples are given for good indications and are beneficial to the patients and are not more expensive versions of what is available at a cheaper cost as sort of a starter kit in order to get the patient on that medication indefinitely at a higher cost. I think that's some of the goals. And so what I would say is we probably need to work on that language to meet the goals that we're looking for.
So, Dr. McCoy, if you have some in the course of, not necessarily today, but next month or so, if you have some language, it would help. That would be appreciated. Are there questions from members of the committee? And you'll be back on the other issues when we get time for that. Okay, next witness then, Pete Wyckoff from Prescription Project. You have to speak loud. It looks like
yes.
You're competing with a concert outside.
For most of my adult life since 1970. Probably a disclaimer at the front end, I have not received any pharmaceutical funding. And actually, probably more important, obviously, in the area that I'm also the president of Karen Wyckoff Rain and Sarcoma Foundation, which is the primary sarcoma foundation in the upper Midwest. Raised right now about $500,000 to the University of Minnesota, quite intentionally. By policy, have refused to accept any type of pharmaceutical money because we believe it will impair our ability to advocate for sarcoma patients. And this is a pretty broad issue, actually, in these areas. Let me just tell you a little bit about the Prescription Project, and I'm going to move through these slides fairly quickly, and I believe you have them in front of you, so I'll be happy to deal with this. This project is a project of Community Catalyst out of Boston, Institute of Medicine as a Profession out of Columbia, all funded by a Pew Charitable Trust out of Philadelphia. Its basic role at one point is try to encourage prescribing of the safest and most effective medications best on the most best available clinical evidence. and to get at that issue by trying to reduce the undue influence of the pharmaceutical industry on the medical profession. Now, this program came about during a time of spiraling drug costs, concerns about safety and efficacy in pharmaceuticals, a constant stream of articles on these issues, court cases challenging the actions of drug companies and regulators. Just to talk briefly about a few of those, obviously the Vioxx case became a major case, led to tens of thousands of unnecessary deaths. As the editor of the Journal of Medicine said, he was hoodwinked by Merck, the maker of the drug. You can look at the kind of marketing that Merck made on this COX-2 painkiller in this area. The clinical trials show that cardiac risk as early as 2000 were suppressed by Merck. And the FDA estimates between 88 and 139,000 cardiac events took place, estimated killing 35 to 55,000 deaths just out of this effort alone. Neurontin. Its off-label use of Neurontin resulted in a $40 million settlement. Off-label marketing, again, promoted by pharmaceutical companies on these issues. And attorney generals in this state and a number of other states have worked to try to deal with these off-label problems. GlaxoSmithKline was sued over suppressing evidence of harm to children from antidepressant Paxil more recently. So we have a problem here of out-of-control industry marketing, industry influence on government, the quality of care is compromised, pharmaceutical costs are out of control, and the inflated costs undermine access to care and affordability for both insured and uninsured, public and private alike. The industry spends approximately $12 billion a year, or about $13,000 a doctor, marketing to doctors. There are 100,000 sales reps. One of every eight doctors try to promote their products to physicians. Gifts, lunches, educational grants, entertainment, free samples are all a part of this. They market to consumers actually less than half of this. So for every dollar we see invested in our evening news, more than $2 is going to the industry to influence the prescriber. $4.5 billion.
Mr. Wyckoff?
Yes.
On that, I was using the number that I heard recently that the direct-to-consumer marketing in Minnesota is $100 million a year.
You may have more data.
So based on the national one, if that same standard held true, they're spending $200 million a year here? It's 2-to-1, you're saying?
Could well be. A
lot of money.
Yes, it is. The focus of these efforts are on new expensive treatments. The ads promote drugs for new diseases in some cases. The most heavily marketed drugs accounted for 50% increase in sales. Now, this chart is a little bit easier to read in this area. The area shows where the amount of dollars is going in terms of billions of dollars. The light blue is the direct office-based marketing cost. The brown just above it is direct-to-consumer and hospital-based. I mean, these are just fascinating issues. You can see the growth of these issues up through 2006. Now, a few things we need to think about and be honest about ourselves. Even small gifts create an obligation and influence prescribing decisions. Free samples create loyalty to brand. Doctors sometimes are paid to promote inexpensive drugs and off-label uses. 84% of physicians believe that gifts influence their prescribing decisions. 84%. These are a line of an effort in the Journal of Medicine of where these people receive those kind of industry relationships. Sales representatives are deal tailors. Again, there's one in every eight physicians in the U.S. They are into relationship building to increase sales of their product. They dispense favorable information about their products and in some cases provide, in this state, small free gifts and services and are generally friendly, attractive, and outgoing. This is from the New York Times area in the way that pharmaceutical companies have created and recruited detailers, salespeople, long-term services. Marketing is 30% of the cost of drugs, only 10 to 15% are research and development. A lot of that expensive Me Too drug marketing. 17% of the cost increases are due to switches to more expensive drugs. And generics, which on the whole are not promoted by the pharmaceutical industry, cost 30 to 80% less. Now, specifically dealing with the Minnesota gift ban legislation, Cody's already gone through this. This came out of the time, actually, initially proposed by Attorney General Skip Humphrey. I'm not going to go through the exceptions because Cody's already done that. JAMA, this is the article reported to this, pharmaceutical payments, laws, and disclosures in Vermont and Minnesota. For the first time, the authors reviewed the data provided through the Minnesota gifting law. Highlighted drug company payments to Minnesota physicians from 2002 to 2004. Payments of $31 million to expenses such as research, consulting, speaker engagements, travel, continuing, and that was only with one quarter of the drug companies providing information. Series of articles by Gardner Harris last year in areas in dealing with this. Doctors side drug may be put to a closed view. Psychiatrist drugs are driven to the role in May. After sanctions, doctor gets company pay. Minnesota Lebanon gifts doctors may catch on, which is partly what this hearing is about today. New York Times showed it that it received at least $57 million. Now, this gets played off in sometimes very harmful way. Again, it's the Gardner Harris issue of a story about Anya Bailey, who was treated for off-label use for atypical antipsychotics and became terribly sick in around issues. And there's a direct correlation, as Gardner Harris just looked at the data on psychiatrists in this state, the off-label use of antipsychotics, atypical psychotics, was about five times higher for people who receive $5,000 or more in payments from the pharmaceutical industry. There is a direct correlation between dollars and doctors' prescribing habits. Now, all sorts of responses have come out of this, part of which you've heard this morning. You already heard from Toby dealing with Physicians Leadership Policy Council. This was maybe came at the beginning of this year, coming out of the health systems in Duluth. Duluth Bay Health System is declaring a total ban on drug local freebies, no matter how small. 18,000 baubles, bangles, and beads for clipboards, clocks, mouse pads, stuffed animals, and other items with drug logos. 18,000 Nexar pens, Convert notepads, Biox notepads, Advair, on and on. It's not funny. And thousands of more, all collected from just four hospitals in the Duluth area and 17 clinics across northeastern Minnesota and northwestern Wisconsin. Why did they do this? Because they're a part of a leading trend of trying to move away from the pharmaceutical companies essentially controlling what is prescribed to this country. It shows people are not in the pharmaceutical back pockets. Or as Dr. Jeff Adams, emerging room physician and professor at the University of Minnesota, said, drug reps are very nice people, but the information they attend tends to be biased. Adding that better sources such as peer-reviewed journals, pharmacists are readily available. More doctors are coming to see that free lunches, even trinkets, may not be harmless either. And it's in that range that we go here. Now, what is a gift? Pretty simply, you know, a gift by definition is a quid pro quo. Something is asked for return. Access to doctors, which is certainly what samples to do, enhances trust and credibility. Various studies show that even small gifts make a difference. Doctors and prescribers just don't need to be indebted in any way to the pharmaceutical industry, as we pointed out graphically this morning. You as legislators understood this years ago with your understanding of limiting gifts from lobbyists to you. Legislators are no more and no less ethical than doctors. You recognize this, and you'll be proud of the efforts you have. Cost of free gifts over $7 billion for all these types of things. There are major enhancements in the new proposed legislation. It clears up much of the ambiguities of the current gift ban legislation, putting clarity around the meaning of gifts and the very definitions we've talked about. It expands the definition of prescriber and practitioner. It covers medical supplies, medical advice, and manufacturers or distributors. It simply bans gifts. It clarifies reporting and public access. It allows samples under certain circumstances, which have already discussed. It clarifies and improves unrestricted granting to medical conferences. It allows for marketing materials to be distributed. It provides transparency for practitioner compensation. It reduces drug company influence on PDL and formulary committees. And one of the statements that formulary committees simply are trying to save money, I never really seemed to be true, as the case that was said this morning. Are free samples really a good thing? Again, they are a relationship-building technique. Samples are usually for newer, more expensive drugs. They usually do not help low-income or uninsured people. Eventually, you need to fill a prescription, which may end up costing you more than the older or other generic. We all have paying for free samples with higher drug prices. Let me just show you this. $18 billion a year is a tool to access prescribers in samples. If you look at 180-day out-of-pocket cost for patients, if they don't receive samples, it's $178. With samples, it's $244. It is increasing cost in the long run. And it generally is also going to those insured and those with higher drug costs.
Can I ask for clarification quickly on this 178 versus 244?
Yep.
Drug costs are so widely varied. Are these for similar types of cases?
It's average drug costs of samples given and non-samples given.
Okay.
And the other big issue is I've sat down with my ophthalmologist, and every time I talk about what I do in life, they always get really interested. And he says, we keep these in a closet. There is no way to track these. There's major safety conditions. I work with this project in Seattle and the Puget Sound Health Alliance of Employers and Direction. Have asked for a ban on all samples purely for safety reasons. Forget all the economic reasons, which we're talking about. For purely safety reasons, they are asking for this to be done in those areas. Now, this is, again, for people who, in the 2008 study just came out this summer, about 72% were well off. The poor were least likely to receive free samples. Individuals of the highest income were the most likely to receive samples. American Dental Public Health out from this past February. Now, the other issues that come around this is doctors aren't influenced by gifts. I hope that we put that one to rest. They, most of them, readily agree. And the private sector is already dealing with this issue. Reminded of a quote by John Adams, the President of the United States, of never trust the lamb to the custody of the wolf. And as we look at this situation in areas, we recognize that pharmaceutical industry, as important as they are, and they are for life-saving drugs in those areas, have basically trying to make money. And you have the undue influence of this issue sitting there way too much. It's a worth area. So I'd be happy to take any particular questions you have. I'd also suggest that there is an answer to that, which is the next item for your discussion this morning.
Thank you. We'll get back to you with the rest of the slideshow after that. Are there any questions from the committee? Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair, just a comment. And in your slides on page 3, the slide which is credited to the New York Times from November of 2005.
Right.
I am not well versed at what qualities make up a good pharmaceutical representative. But I think that it is disappointing at best.
I agree. Totally agree with you.
That this is even included in your presentation.
We only put it in there because, unfortunately, that's what the industry has really said in the areas that are there. But that's the way I take that.
Thank you. Mr. Grotchek.
Chair Committee, my name is Dean Grotchek. I'm the Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Senior Federation. I want to thank the committee for the opportunity to give testimony today. I'm going to make it really short, being last, and we're already crunching the time. I want to talk about the bees that Minnesota Senior Federation is backing this legislation in some very broad terms. Basically, it's economics, folks. Boils down to our organization has been involved in a long time in drug issues. We've done importation. We have an importation program. We now run and operate a state copy of that program. We've done the bus trips to Canada. We've owned a pharmacy, all with the specific intent of trying to lower drug costs in sort of the interim between the time of actual need and public policy change. The issue as it relates to gifts to physicians really comes down to one fundamental question for most of my membership, and that is the degree to which it influences the decision of a physician in terms of the prescriptions that my membership is taking home. And when you get into a situation where they begin to question that relationship and the decision-making process, then we have a problem, all right? And right now, the sense with my membership is that there are these other outside influences determining what drugs they're taking, and it's not always just the case of the drug being taken or being prescribed solely for the benefit of the patient, all right? Now, whether it's true or not is immaterial, because it really is a situation where the perception has become a problem, all right? Now, I don't know how many of you read this morning's Minneapolis paper, but one of the articles in the Minneapolis paper this morning talked about a drug device maker here in Minnesota that the headline was rather sensational in terms of saying that there is a problem in terms of their financial relationship with the clinic, et cetera, et cetera. The trust level of the consumer is being diminished greatly. And this legislation is the type of legislation that the consumer feels is the right step in order to rebalance that trust issue. I also want to speak just for a second. As I was listening to one of the former speakers, Ms. Powell, and her discussion about farmers taking on regulating this relationship between detailers and physicians, I was reminded of something I heard about 3 weeks ago, and it was a very similar situation as we are in today, though it was at the federal level. The former Fed chair of the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan, was asked if he had any regrets about his time as Fed chair. And he sat for a couple of seconds and didn't say anything, and then he said, yes, I trusted the financial industry and the fact that they would self-regulate voluntarily because it was in the best interest. And the last statement he made was, I was wrong. All right? And what we're looking at right now is stepping into that relationship to remove the undue influences and to restore the confidence of patients that the prescription that they're actually going home with is in their best interest and is not influenced outside the direct relationship with them and the physicians. I have pages of stuff with it.
Thank you. Any questions from members of the committee? Thank you very much. We'll quickly turn to the academic detailing issue. And Dr. McCoy, you're going to start out, I guess. Handing out a bill draft, this is something I had asked to have prepared. And this is just a draft on the issue. And Dr. McCoy, you're going to briefly explain what it is first, I hope, to start up.
Yes. Good morning again, I'm Dr. McCoy, and I realize I forgot my own disclosures. I personally did not meet with the pharmaceutical representatives or receive any funds from the drug companies and have divested myself of all pharmaceutical company stock that I prior owned before becoming a physician. So With that said, I will briefly discuss the academic detailing. I think Peter Wyckoff will be able to give a little bit more detail, but I'll get sort of the physician's perspective from it. So way back in 2002, there was a landmark study funded by the National Institutes of Health that found that the best first-line therapies for high blood pressure turned out to be inexpensive generic medications after studying the generics versus the high-cost, at that time, very new medications. Found out the generic one turned out to be best. However, after 6 years, physicians continued to prescribe the cost of brand-name medications when the generic medications would have indeed been first-line. The question is, why does that happen? And the answer, as I'm sure the committee has heard prior, is that the pharmaceutical industry does spend billions of dollars a year to promote its medications. They employ tens of thousands of drug detailers and meet physicians on a regular basis to tout their products. Drug companies seek to make physicians think of their products first when they reach for their prescription pad. They spend millions of dollars researching how to be the most effective marketing profession. And physicians do respond to this marketing in very demonstrable ways. Unfortunately, generic medications and non-pharmaceutical therapies do not have such vocal, persistent, and persuasive advocates. Therapy guidelines that are developed by expert panels are often overwhelmed by the marketing forces of the drug companies. One proven way to change the practice patterns of physicians is what's been called academic detailing. It's been demonstrated in Pennsylvania, Maine, and Vermont, and programs have also recently been started in New York, Washington, D.C., and South Carolina. While there are many variations on the theme, to be most effective, these programs include a face-to-face contact between an expert, content expert, and physicians. This builds a relationship between the healthcare provider and a non-biased source of information. A 2007 review by the Cochrane Collaboration, which for academic medicine is considered the gold standard of reviewing of literature, they found that academic detailing has been shown to change prescribing patterns so there's an effective way. It may also further reduce costs when focused on prescription drugs or other expensive modalities, and things in this country would particularly may include imaging and procedure-based medicine. I do want to spend a minute to talk about what academic detailing is not. It's not primarily a cost containment program. While it may still have cost containment benefits, if you approach it from that perspective, you will often end up focusing only on drug costs, as opposed to having a broader program that promotes evidence-based medicine, which is what we want for improving the health of the generation of the population throughout the state. It's also not a punitive measure for high-volume prescribers, so you don't search your databases looking for which doctors prescribe those medications and then detail it to them. You make it offer, you offer it out to everyone who, all the providers who would like to seek evidence-based medicine from unbiased sources. It also is not mandatory education, but rather an option for physicians to obtain information they find useful. One successful mechanism has been used to allow to offer CME credit for physicians, which makes it very useful to them, both because it meets their licensure requirements, but also provides non-biased sources of information. Academic detailing is effective because it provides education about an entire class of therapies, including non-pharmacologic therapies, for a particular disease. This presentation is very useful to practicing physicians rather than focusing on a single drug or a single agent. Talk about the whole class and see how to balance the benefits of the various drugs that are available. While reduced cost of pharmaceutical drugs may indeed result from academic detailing, you shouldn't consider that the primary goal. I think that's one of the things that we're going to get across. Yes, cost control is something that may result from this, but if you approach it from that perspective, you may end up with a program that doesn't have the results on the long term that you'd be looking for. The goal should be to provide evidence-based medicine and practices to physicians. There indeed have been studies showing cost savings using best practices that exceed the investment that was needed to operate the academic detailing program, and I did bring some of that evidence with me. It's a bit of a wonkish paper, but I'd be happy to provide that. And finally, I think it's important to recognize that physicians want to have unbiased sources of evidence. And we'll seek it out and we'll request it if it's made available, particularly by a trusted source such as state-sponsored detailers or academic information. One piece I did want to mention when you're thinking about drafting this legislation is, well, it is reasonable to consider wanting to have the academic detailers under the same regulations and restrictions of the FDA. Be careful to recognize that some of the FDA limitations on what can be detail through the drug company includes restrictions on only indications that have been FDA approved as opposed to off-label marketing, whereas there may be a role for off-label marketing by academic detailing, assuming that there is an oversight committee or oversight structure in such a way to ensure that it is appropriate to use of evidence-based off-label practicing. Additionally, the FDA, I believe, restricts detailers to talking only about a single agent, a single drug, when they talk to a physician. And if you put the academic detailers under the same restrictions as the FDA has for detailers, you would limit their ability to talk about a broad class of medications or three or four different agents or non-pharmaceutical agents or non-pharmaceutical therapies in such treatments. And so it's important to review what the FDA actually requires when. So rather than just having a blanket statement that says, you know, academic detailers will be required to follow the same guidelines as, you know, FDA has spelled out, to look at those FDA guidelines to make sure you're not, in fact, tying the hands unexpectedly of the academic detailers.
It's helpful information. Can I ask a quick question about who does the detailing in the states that have this?
The states that have it are often it's a pharmacist. Vermont actually has a pharmacist and a physician team that go out and meet with physicians. Other states have hired people with medical backgrounds, either pharmacy or physician assistants or others with some medical background, provided them with training both in the disease class and encouraged them to develop their own training materials, their education materials within that disease class, but also provide education about how to be effective communicators to physicians in a one-on-one setting.
Do you have any idea how many of the pharmacists, I mean the drug company detailers are pharmacists or doctors?
I don't know.
Most? Few? Most? Few? None?
I have met one, I believe, in my career, though limited as it is, who I did have a pharmacy or nursing background. But most of them do not have medical background and training. They have a bachelor's degree in history or social sciences.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. McCoy, can you... is there a difference in how this detailer might work in a practice setting where maybe I have a solo practice or maybe I have a practice with, you know, it's relatively small, probably not in a not metropolitan area, versus perhaps the institution that you're affiliated with?
Sure. The academic detailing has been demonstrated in such places as Australia, which has incredibly rural practices, and where the detailers will go out to those single or solo practices or small group practices and often meet with the physicians one-on-one. They found that one-on-one actually is the most effective way of communicating with the physician because it allows a two-way stream of communication. The physician can request, well, could you provide more information about this? And so it becomes much more physician-focused in terms of what they are looking for. But it can be done in small groups as well. Typically, it's good for those sorts of practices where they don't have access to a giant academic medical center for continuing medical education or finding out what the newest and latest is in the research world. So it brings that information out to the practicing providers. I don't know in New York and Pennsylvania what percentage of the physicians at the large academic institutions are participants in this program versus those that are out of private practice.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the help on that. Dr. Weiberg again. Mr. Gratzik, I hear you're not going to speak on this bill, so you'll have two more. Okay. Welcome back.
Yes. Again, my name is Dr. Cody Weinberg. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Pharmacy. And I just have a couple of comments about this, and then with the committee's indulgence, I might say a little bit about samples myself from the last discussion. The two things that I basically wanted to talk to you about this is, first of all, some committee members may know that before I came to the board in September of 2005, I was the Department of Human Services Pharmacy Program Manager. So I spent about 6 years looking in depth at cost issues, which we don't look at all for the board. And, of course, we were faced with much of those 6 years with budget deficits, just as the state faces that today. And we put a number of policies in place that collectively my successor tells me have, at this point, cumulatively saved somewhere between $300 and $400 million. One of the things that we looked at actually was trying to come up with some sort of an academic detailing program for just through the Medicaid program, basically through the Department of Human Services. We were concerned that the marketing efforts of the manufacturers were promoting more costly drugs when cheaper alternatives were available. We decided not to pursue that because, frankly, we took a much more direct approach, which is establishing a preferred drug list supplemental rebate program, and we also established some traditional prior authorization requirements for some of the drugs we thought were most expensive and least beneficial. In addition to that, the department, per federal law, is required to conduct what's known as retrospective drug utilization review. And that involves the analysis of claims data to look for some indications that maybe drugs are being inappropriately prescribed. As an example, one of the things we looked at was the use of three or more antipsychotics at one time. There were a surprising number of Medicaid recipients who were on three or more distinct antipsychotics at one time. And so we would send a letter out to the physicians saying, we know there may be something special about this particular case, but really that's probably not the standard of care, and ask them to report back. So we were doing not really academic detailing. We weren't sending people out there in person, but through the drug utilization review program, we were doing that. So that's just one thing I'd like to talk about. The other thing, at this point, is sort of unofficial because I have not brought this particular bill before the board itself, but in looking at the funding mechanism on page 3, it talks about the Board of Pharmacy increasing the licensing fees for drug manufacturers. There would be two things about that. Boards, health licensing boards, can actually no longer increase fees by rule. So we would have to actually work with the legislature, if this is what the legislature wants to do, to determine what an appropriate fee increase would be to fund the program, and the legislature would actually have to enact that fee increase because we cannot raise fees by rule. The second thing is, I haven't talked to the board about this, but I suspect that this type of funding would be preferential to another sort of funding that is happening out there right now. Washington, D.C. Passed a ordinance or whatever the city does that basically licenses pharmaceutical representatives and uses the licensing fees to fund an academic detailing program. And it's the Board of Pharmacy in D.C. that does that. I think it would probably be preferable from an administrative perspective to increase fees for an entire company rather than try to individually license however many hundreds or thousands or however many pharmaceutical reps there are in the state. That would be far simpler administratively to do.
So, Dr. Weber, on that, just for clarification, because we have a little trouble hearing with the band out there.
Yeah.
But in other words, the language in here on increasing the fee for ed manufacturers would be easier to administer than the alternative of putting the licensing thing on
individual reps. Exactly. It would be far easier to do that. In terms of samples, and again, this is my own personal opinion, it has nothing to do with the board, it has a lot to do with when I worked with Medicaid and looked at cost issues. I know it would be actually an incredibly difficult thing to do, and I know that the folks from Farber would disagree with me, but, and I regret Senator Lynch can't hear this, but if the idea was cost containment, and if it were not going to be characterized as taking something free away from your constituents, if cost containment was an issue, you would probably want to ban samples. Samples are not free. The cost of the samples is incorporated into the prices that the manufacturers charge. Even a particular patient who may benefit initially from a sample, as I think someone else pointed out, eventually, if they remain on the drug, is going to have to pay for it. And they may find that either their insurance doesn't cover it at all, or if they're insured, as most insurers do, has a multi-tier copay system, they may be paying the highest copays, because often, not always, often the products that are sampled, there are equivalent products that or products on the market that are far cheaper that will do the same thing. So this is also something, you know, we certainly would not have suggested it over at the Department of Human Services, but when we were looking at cost drivers, that's one thing that we looked at. Also, I would echo the safety issues and just the issues that I perceive that clinics may have managing samples. There was a law passed by Congress back in 1987, the Prescription Drug Marketing Act, that put significant restrictions on samples, which was appropriate because back before then, they were being diverted and they were being resold. And the problem, though, is that this restriction is that physicians are the ones that get samples now. There are some manufacturers, to their credit, have established programs where instead of the physician handing out the sample, they will give a coupon or a voucher that the patient can take to a pharmacy where it can be filled just as any other prescription would be filled, including being labeled with adequate instructions for use. Right now, if samples come from the physician themselves, they're probably not being labeled with instructions for use. The board has no authority. Nobody actually, I understand, regulates clinics in the state. Nobody has the authority to go in and make sure that the drugs are properly stored. In addition to that, the board has had requests from pharmacies that have been in clinics. They've asked for a variance to be allowed to handle the samples on behalf of the physicians, and we've had to tell them they really can't do that because the board can't authorize that because it would be a violation of the federal law. So, again, those are all just a personal take on the issue of samples.
So if we are to allow some samples, you'd say it might make more sense to require them to use coupons so they're safely stored in hand, and the patient information goes out with it.
I think that's a better way to have them somehow, you know, have the mechanism somehow go through a pharmacy. I think that's probably a safer mechanism. I think it creates less problems for people trying to store and handle samples in the clinics.
Thank you. Senator Johnson and Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to echo Marjorie Powell's statement, though, when she was talking about the trials. When you are trying to manage high blood pressure, diabetes, whatever illness you have to trial many, many drugs to find your own particular tolerance. And I think that one-on-one conversation with the physician at the time you're taking that sample home is way more important than the leaflet you get from the pharmacist. I'm going to remember that conversation. I'm not going to read the leaflet. I'd like to see the samples stay in the pharmacist's office. That's my comment.
Senator Dow.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Just so I know, Doctor, if you're taking some of these drugs, they take a while to, you know, take effect, right? Your body has to, you might have to take them for 30 days before you start to see the effects of those things. Is that correct on some of these drugs?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dahl, it depends on the medication. Some medications can have relatively quick effects, and you can also see the adverse effects relatively quickly. On the other hand, there are medications. A classic example would be antidepressants. This is an area that was my specialty early on. Antidepressants can take 4 to 6 to 8 weeks to exert their full effect.
And so, Mr. Chair, what I'm thinking down this line, that if they give out a free sample and it does work, then you're not going to switch from that drug. I mean, if there were alternatives to use, if you've got a free sample and you started on that program, that's the one you're on. It's like being the drug dealer on the street. You give them a couple of samples, they get hooked, and that's the one they're going to go with. So it's more likely they'll continue to buy that particular product versus another alternative, simply because it's going to take them another 4 to 6 weeks to start up on something new, even if it was cheaper.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dahl, that's probably correct, and that's one of the issues it could very well be in for certain drugs, that had they not tried sample, but had been prescribed in the existing drug that was available generically, the generic drug might have worked just as well, and it, in the long run, would have saved them no money.
Thank you.
Thank you. Sarah Johnson.
To that, then, once the tolerance has been, you know, you go through this process of deciding which drug you're going to take, then the physician can write for the generic.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, there may not be a generic for that particular drug. One example that most people probably would be aware of are the drugs that are known as statins to reduce cholesterol. There are some of those that have generics available. There's some that do not. And in certain circumstances, someone may do just as well with generic. I mean, I can speak to this personally. I was on brand name Lipitor until Zocor went generic, and I switched myself to Simvastatin, generic version, to save a copay, actually, and also because I trusted that the drug would work. And for me, it did. Now, it doesn't do that for everyone. But, I mean, there's an example. Had someone been getting samples of a drug like Lipitor, and had they not had the knowledge, personal knowledge I do about the available options, they might get on that, think that there is not an option for them, and actually end up paying more for drugs in the long run.
Thank you very much. Marjorie Powell asked for a very brief comment, so we'll maybe have her go first and then close with you, Mr. Wyckoff. Try and get out of here as soon as we can, so... Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you. I just wanted very quickly to say three things. Putting into context all of the discussion about pharmaceutical marketing, I think it's important to remember that generic prescriptions make up almost 70% of all scripts that are filled in the United States. And I understand that Minnesota has a mandatory generic substitution law. So generics are what a patient gets when there is a generic available. And as Cody indicated, many physicians have switched patients from a brand to a generic when a generic becomes available within a category of products. But the generic of a slightly different formulation may not work for all patients. So the physician needs to be involved in making that decision. So I think you need to remember all of the discussion about marketing expenses, some of which is unverifiable data, needs to be put in the context of 70% of all scripts are generic, and pharmaceuticals have traditionally, over the last probably 15 years, constituted 10 cents out of every healthcare dollar they go. They fluctuate between 9.5 cents and 10.5 cents, but approximately 10 cents of every healthcare dollar has consistently been spent on pharmaceuticals. All healthcare costs are rising. We happen to see pharmaceutical costs because the structure, the way insurance companies have structured co-pays so that you pay a relatively flat copay to go visit your doctor, but you pay a variable copay depending on what prescription drug you get. As I look at the academic detailing bill, I'm struck by one thing. I understand that physicians have continuing medical education requirements here in Minnesota, and that rather than creating an entirely new structure, it might be equally efficient to simply require that physicians, as part of their continuing medical education, have a session every year that would focus on the use of prescription medicines within it could vary by healthcare area. I've not had a chance to think that through, but essentially this is establishing a different system for continuing medical education for physicians, and groups like the Mayo Clinic, which already provides CME for physicians, could do that under the existing CME structure without the need for creating an additional structure either at the Board of Pharmacy or anyplace else. So I urge you to think about that as an alternative approach.
Sarah Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Powell. Those were exactly going to be my comments. I was going to save them until the end of Mr. Wyckoff's statement, because I'm sure he's going to be saying a few of those same things. But I would like to see a bill like the first one we listened to get into place, see if the industry could do some self-regulation. And again, there's an appropriation at the end of this. There's a blank appropriations, and there's a whole new program. We're not in a position as a state right now to be creating a whole new program. But I'd like to see us go step by step into this regulation before we do something like this. And I like your suggestion that, yeah, the continuing ed could cover this. Thank you.
Ms. Powell, I kind of wonder about that, too. Would the pharmaceutical e-tabers, would they be willing to stop, too, as long as we had that continuing ed requirement?
In many instances, the pharmaceutical detailers are fulfilling obligations that the FDA imposes on pharmaceutical companies. When you have particularly a medication that has potentially serious side effects or that can be used by some patients but not other patients, and the physician needs to be very careful about which patients that might be, that the FDA says that you pharmaceutical company only have approval to market this product, to make it available for patients, if you are providing education to physicians. For example, all of the controlled substances, the pharmaceutical companies have an obligation to both monitor who's prescribing and make sure that those physicians have all the accurate information about when and how to use them. There are medicines for multiple sclerosis. An increasing number of medicines come with requirements that the pharmaceutical company, in fact, inform physicians. So if in some cases the pharmaceutical company would not be able to say, we will stop informing physicians. And frankly, when there is information about an unanticipated side effect, the pharmaceutical companies make a concerted effort to get out and tell physicians that you shouldn't be using this with this category of patients, or watch out particularly for. So there are some broader obligations that pharmaceutical companies have.
Ms. Powell, in that case, though, would they be, you think the companies would be willing in other cases to withdraw their detailers in exchange for the continuing ed and require doctors or some medical professional to do the detailing when there's medical requirement for the FDA?
In many cases, pharmaceutical companies are, in fact, for a variety of reasons, cutting back on detailers. But I don't, as a general position, we would not be in a position to say, yes, we would encourage our companies to stop informing doctors about the appropriate use of their medicine, because we think that's an important thing to do. Now, we have said it within the context of our code that we think there are some conditions under which that should happen, and we frankly have also told our companies that we think it's important for them to continue to support continuing medical education programs, but do that in the existing mechanism that allows for independent decision-making about the content of those programs, the speakers at those programs, and that excludes promotional materials from pharmaceutical companies from any of the area in which the program has occurred. And we've said it's not appropriate for our companies to fund the meals of those programs. We can provide grants to the program as a whole, and if the sponsor decides that that should include lunch, that would be fine.
Thank you. Senator Dahl?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to take a little side trip just briefly on something you just said. The drugs that are approved by the FDA, there's only a certain subset that require that there be some additional detailing for the use and the prescription of those drugs.
FDA FDA several years ago started what it called risk management programs. In the FDA amendments of 2006, I think, the Congress changed that to create a risk evaluation and mitigation strategies program, where the FDA is encouraged to approve products that have potentially serious side effects or that are useful for subsets of populations, but impose on those companies a system whereby the company provides unique, specialized education to prescribers about the effects of those drugs, how to identify the patients who will and will not be successful on those on that medication. So FDA is expanding that kind of program, and there will be increasing numbers of products where the prescriber won't be able to prescribe unless they've been through an FDA-approved training program operated by the pharmaceutical company, and the prescriber may periodically have to go back to a training program. In some instances, the FDA is saying pharmacies can't dispense unless the pharmacist provides or checks certain information with either the patient or the prescribing physician. So there are going to be increasing requirements.
And Mr. Chair and Ms. Powell, then, and the way they determine the pharmaceutical companies determine who those prescribers are is from the physician's prescribing data that they access to find out.
That's correct. Because that information is available, a pharmaceutical company that has a product that's under a risk management strategy will use that information to make sure that all of the physicians who are prescribing have in fact been through their training program. And the DEA also requires that for companies that are marketing controlled substances, so that if, for example, I'm marketing a product that is used for the treatment of breakthrough pain, physician with a general practice shouldn't be prescribing very much of that, and I may in fact not ever detail that physician. I may not provide them with information because I don't think that they would be prescribing my product very often. Not many general practitioners treat patients with serious breakthrough pain, patients who are on pain maintenance medication. But I then, as a company, have an obligation to look at every physician who is prescribing that product and say, Dr. Powell has never talked to a representative from the company. I need to be sure somebody goes out and makes sure that Dr. Powell knows when and how to be prescribing that and isn't, in fact, prescribing inappropriately.
One last question, and just to the best of your knowledge, the practice of using that data, then, is it expanded beyond just those drugs that are required to have the detailing, and it's used for all classes of drugs to get physicians to change their prescribing habits?
My understanding, and it is limited because I also wear an antitrust hat, I can't get into too much detail on individual company marketing practices, but my understanding from the general discussions is that some companies use prescriber identifiable data to direct their pharmaceutical representatives to talk to a physician who appears to have patients falling in this category to tell them about our new product. In some instances, they may say, Dr. Dahl is prescribing X. Why don't you talk to him and see if you can convince him that he should try prescribing Y, which treats the same condition. Other companies don't use the information at all for their marketing people, but use it to identify physicians who may have a practice that would allow them to recruit patients for a clinical trial.
Okay.
So I think there are varied uses, and they vary across companies.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. On your way out, you did. I was intrigued by your idea of continuing education earlier. If you would go when you go back, if you would be willing to check with the members of PhRMA to see how many of them would be willing to do two things. One, withdraw all their detailers except on the drugs they're required to by FDA. And number two, for those folks, see if they'd be willing to require, just voluntarily, that they require their detailers be their pharmacists or physicians. I'd be interested in hearing how many would, because I think it might be some real potential to try your alternative if they'd be willing to do that.
Senator, I would be happy to do that, but I do need to tell you that before I can ask the companies that, I will have to get permission
I understand
from our
that.
Outside antitrust
okay.
lawyer, because my immediate response was, if somebody in pharma came to me with that request, I'd say, I think I have some concerns with getting into.
Yeah, the only reason I ask is because I think your idea would be intriguing, because I think if both sides, if the academic people who want to give the neutral information out, if they could be covered by the continuing ed, I think the marketing people, if they're willing to live by the same standards, that might be potential. So find out if you can ask them that, and if not, maybe we can ask them that directly.
And it's not clear to me that the companies would have to be willing to withdraw their detailers. I don't know that when you require other continuing medical education, that you say that's the only source of the information that doctors could get, because doctors do and will continue to read professional articles in the peer-reviewed literature and elsewhere.
Right, I agree, and that's why I think we might need both the continuing ed and the academic detailing. But thank you. I appreciate any information you can get on that. Mr. Wyckoff.
Senator Marty, committee members, thank you for having me back. I will try to be brief, but I'm also going to try to give you a feeling of what this is from people who know far more than I do. The problem is we perceive it as a prescription drug. It's 60-70% of all pharmaceutical information doctors receive in the pharmaceutical industry, according to various studies. And it's also true that doctors have little time with current relevant information. And most doctors would like to receive current, unbiased, non-compromised information in a convenient way. And that's kind of the dilemma which is there. I want to provide you some background, which actually comes from Frank May, who was at Harvard and a visiting clinical professor. He also was the person who founded and developed the Australian Academic Detailing Program more than a decade ago, which has proven to be highly successful on a national level. And he really developed and worked that program. An opportunity to be with him in the early part of this week. First of all, what is academic detailing? It is a personalized service and support for good clinical decision-making and repeated one-to-one encounters. It's really a person-to-person situation. We need to give a lot of credit to the pharmaceutical industry. The reason they have 100,000 detailers is because it works to sell their products. They do that in their own personal space, i.e. their clinics, as opposed to going out for an academic, for a CME from other locations. They're specially trained in communications with healthcare background. They have clear message academic detailers. Clear messages are delivered in such a way they become relevant to each doctor's own perceived needs. So it's tailored against that. The message facilitates better patient care and are often focused around decision-making about prescribing. They are unbiased by commercial or other extraneous interests. And they also provide useful support between encounters. Now, the term was actually coined about 25 years ago by a number of folks coming out of Harvard and others. You see in various literature being referred to in these terms as well. Now, academic uses the conventions established by the pharmaceutical industry because they work. They include face-to-face encounters, between encounter support services, as opposed to providing, if you will, the company line or the line from the pharmaceutical industry, it is providing unbiased, up-to-date information. So there are critical differences between industry detailing and academic detailing. There is independence or unbiased influences, which you certainly do not have in pharmaceutical detailing.
There is training of academic detailers far beyond what's normal training for industry detailers. The training does deal with communication skills, topical knowledge, and clinical and interpretation skills to really be able to work with them. Print materials and supporting communications are readily available in an unbiased way. I'll show you an example of that in a second. And there is no primary pursuit of the dichotomous outcomes, either a buy or no buy. As Senator Dahl was pointing out, when you have a pharmacist or a detail person going to a doctor's office, they know what that doctor is prescribing. As Powell indicated, many times they're trying to move that prescribing from one doctor to another, to the company that they are representing. And it's in that situation that none of that is transpiring with academic detailers. There's no buy or no buy formula in that situation. This is simply one example. The research on this issue has absolutely nothing to do with Minnesota in issues. The way we respond to medications and do it and the best therapeutic outcomes is really international in its status. Does it work? Yes. Education outreach vision with or without additional interventions can be effective in improving practice in the majority of circumstances, but the effect is variable. Interactive techniques, including audit feedback, academic detailing, outreach, and reminders, are the most effective at simultaneously changing physician care and patient outcomes. Clinical practice guidelines and opinion leaders are less effective. That's kind of the CME issue. Area dietetic presentations and distributed print information only have little or no beneficial effect in changing physician practice. Again, the CME kind of issues. And a major study that was done here. Why does it work? Visitors are well presented and well briefed. The timing is at the doctor's convenience. The doctor does not need to interpret their normal routine. The doctor is on their own ground. The message is concise and clearly relevant to their patient care. The encounter is almost in real time. Trust and relationships, again, are built between the academic detailers and the practitioners over time, much as pharmaceutical industry is trying to reach a relationship which is obviously conflicted at best. Recollections of previous value from academic detailing services leverage future practice changes and suggested knowledge transfer. It simply works in the areas that it does. Is it cost-effective? A Harvard study, for every dollar spent on academic detailing program returns $2 in reduced cost. To invest in this program will return $2 in effect to the area. The PACE study...
Can I interrupt and ask clarification on that? In that study, were the detailers going only to Medicaid doctors, or were they going to... Do you know if that's the case?
I honestly don't know that particular one.
Okay.
The second one was not, though, for sure. The PACE study, PACE, as you may know, in this case, it's a different PACE. This is a Pennsylvania prescription drug program for Pennsylvania citizens, which focused just on one class of drugs in the study in an area, a little purple pill, if you will, or acid reflux, and cheaper, equally effective cousins. It showed reduced cost of $120 per month per doctor, $378 per month for the heaviest prescribers. The changes persisted that would equate to $572,000 or savings over cost over $1 million simply for the purple pill in Pennsylvania. And on top of that, we're talking about increased access, in many cases increased quality outcomes.
Can I ask one more on that one?
That deals with Medicare, Medicaid, and state employees.
$572,000. Would be less than the cost of the $1 million, but you're saying that the cost was
the 500 savings against the program cost of
If that's just for the one drug, the savings, but the detailing is for multiple drugs.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
There are other direct savings. I mean, there are direct savings in generics prescribed instead of higher priced brand names. Less expensive therapeutic equivalents are prescribed. Different therapeutic approaches, i.e. diuretics or beta blockers. In certain cases, you may be really looking at no prescription or lifestyle changes. There are indirect savings as well. Unnecessarily prescription, unnecessary side effects, unnecessary interactions, and increased efficacy. You know, less expensive drug be more effective, and yes, in many cases, it can. So,
I'm not actually going to look at the Australian issue, but this is, again, been going on for over 10 years. The savings there were over $324 million in a much smaller issue over a period of time. You can see the savings in the number of educational visits that were happening in Australia coming up there in the Sydney study. Academic detailing implementing is happening in the United States right now. Managed care organizations are beginning to set it up. Groups like Kaiser Permanente are beginning to work on this. Other healthcare entities. Governments in the state of New York, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, South Carolina, Vermont, D.C., and more have begun to really institute these programs, all showing quantitative improvements in outcomes, huge physician satisfaction, over 80% interest in area by physicians, and reduced cost. The types of things we're talking about, again, normally a 2-to-1 or more savings as far as the amount invested into it. On top of that, you have the Federal Independent Drug Evaluation Outreach Act of 2000, or ID, which will grant to states for evidence-based prescription programs, grants to develop evidence-based programs for my programs. And this program is, you know, is getting a lot of interest. It's in a lot of the proposed programs that are coming down and has strong bipartisan support. So we believe it's an effective policy to deal with the confounded information about available drug therapies, a commercial interest in conventional and continuing medical education about prescription drugs, and that's the commercial interest is another whole issue of the commercialization of CMEs. It's also attained better balance between drug costs and patient and community benefit. A research and now operational validated tool for achieving better value and better outcomes from prescription drugs in medical care. Proposed legislation, as you have it here, is a public-private partnership between the Health Department, the Board of Pharmacy, University of Minnesota Medical School. It encouraged participation of physicians, pharmacists, health care providers, and health care companies. It has strong components. It builds on the work of other states. We don't need to replicate what's happening elsewhere. It puts us in line for possible academic detail national funding. And again, it is funded out of new dedicated dollars and drug manufacturers' licensing fees is being proposed. It will have saved the states millions of dollars and, most importantly, improve the quality of Minnesota health care. This is just kind of where things are going on around the country right now. Again, Minnesota is the only Oregon state that has an outright gift ban. Massachusetts is now taking foot and now implementing their law. Gift disclosure legislation, prescriber education, academic detailers are happening in these programs. Prescriber privacy, which really deal with the data mining issues more than anything else, which is just upheld to the courts in a very, very strong decision. Is moving and expanding in a number of other states as well. So that's kind of the current state of the art at this point. Any questions that you have? I'm please.
My only one was with Senator Dahl. You're going to bring your data mining bill back related to his last question about the prescriber privacy?
I haven't intend to do something with that, but I think there's some place for it, Mr. Chair. Obviously, if there's federal requirements that need to push some of that data forward to educate physicians and prescribers, but I don't know that we need to discuss further. I think some things came up last session that raised some questions for me, and we'll continue those discussions, but that is the intent. In terms of this particular program, I like the idea. However, I do see it's being layering on a whole other program on here that's going to be very expensive to do.
Except it's funded out of the industry, which is it's in effect counter advertising to the.
And actually, it will save the state money in the long run. So you've really got the front end cost being paid either by this kind of mechanism or possibly the national funding, which may come down on this. And again, the results across the country and across the world are showing that this actually improves quality, which again is the most important piece, and significantly reduces cost.
Mr. Rakoff, on your page 11 of your slide, the slide about the Australian program mm-hmm. saving $324 million, do you have any clue how much the cost of that was? That's the net savings, is the $324, I presume?
No, I can get that real quick.
I'd appreciate it if you could.
Dr. May is readily available. I have a cell phone.
Thank you. Any other questions from a member of the committee? If not, we will be addressing these issues more during the session, and we will get to more discussion at that time. With that, this meeting is adjourned.